thank you for tuning in to this very special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we celebrate a return appearance from our great friend, film critic Tony Macklin. You can read all of Tony's criticism and listen in on his numerous filmmaker interviews at his website at tonymacklin.net. For tonight's show, we decided to do something a little different. Tony and I both would pick five movies from the decade of the 70s, reveal them to one another in conversation, and see where that conversation took us. It turned out to be one of the most insightful and invigorating conversations we've ever shared on the show.
Well, if you compare that age, the 70s, with the films today, it's incredibly different. The films of the 70s were, not all of them, of course, but there was alienation and irony. And when I looked at them, did all this rethinking of this, visiting back to the past and tasting the wine, and it was still tart and kind of bittersweet at this point. But how many films at that time had negative or downbeat endings? You very seldom see that today. I'm just going to go through a quick list, and this is just the top of the subject. Godfather 2, five Easy Pieces, he's alone. Nashville ends in an assassination. Dirty Harry, he throws away his badge. King of Marvin Gardens, the Bruce character is shot. Chinatown, Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, McCabe and Mrs. Miller ending up in the drug den. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he, at least his image, is still alive, but he's dead and gone. Conversation, The Candidate, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And Hitchcock made one of his most negative endings. I mean, we think immediately of Psycho and The Birds, but the one that may be the most negative and the sense of human nature being devastated is Frenzy, which was in that. And our friend Kubrick, Barry Lyndon, with Ryan O'Neill, what happens to him at the end. So you go through all of these masterpieces or near masterpieces.
The Parallax view comes to mind.
Sure. You know, Parallax view would be another one.
Warren Beatty gets shot in the face at the very last.
Well, I think one of the things about why I so much liked the Coen brothers Inside Llewellyn Davis, was my best picture this year, is it's a 70s picture. It has the texture, it has the rhythms, it has the qualities, it also has the alienation and the irony that are so absent from so many films today. I mean, how can you be ironic about a celebrity culture? I don't see how you can. You can't be ironic about so much that is absurd, and irony has melted away or has just disappeared from so many of our films.
So here's the premise to let our listeners know. I came to you last week and I said, hey, why don't we pick five movies each from the decade of the 70s? What's the word for it? A prerequisite.
There's no sleep. I haven't slept since.
You know, whatever you'd like to talk about, whatever five movies, they could be random, they could be your favorite, they could, whatever. And let's see what comes out of it. I don't know your choices. You don't know mine. So this is exciting. Maybe I haven't seen some of your choices, and it'll bring up interesting discussions. So
you have seen them all, my man, and you've interpreted them all. And you've lived all, so don't play this game with me.
No, you'd be surprised. I have some blind spots, so and that's why I depend on movie fanatics like you, so I can fill in those blind spots.
I am not a fanatic. I'm an intelligent, perceptive viewer.
I'm so sorry. Okay, So give me your first choice that you wanted to discuss.
Okay. This could be 40 different films. I mean, they've been fighting me for the last few days for a place on the list, and I've replaced two, and I've replaced three, and then I've moved one up, and I've moved one down. But the number five is a film that was made in 27 days for $500,000 in 1973. And it was the first time that Scorsese had ever met Robert De Niro. And they went on to make eight films together. And my pick of that is Mean Streets. And there's so much, the work still has Scorsese's spirit. I think if you mention the five most Scorsese films, the ones with his personality and his character and his creativity, that's got to be on the list of five. And he actually appeared in it himself. They made it non-union. It was, as I said, low budget. He played the henchman who sits in the back of the car and at the end shoots Charlie and Johnny Boy De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the major things, maybe the most major thing of the films of the 1970s, was the personal vision, and particularly the personal vision of the director. And this, especially the first 5 years, but it was the golden age of the personal vision of the director, of the creator, before money changed everything.
And I was talking about this on the show the other night, when it comes to directors and their particular styles. We were talking about Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson has a very particular style that he's built over the course of his career. And I heard an interview with him, and he said, you know, after a while and making so many movies, I just realized, well, this is the way I like to see things. This is the particular way I like to frame them. I just happened upon my vision. It wasn't something that was conscious from the beginning. But then you have directors that seem fully realized, fully formed, right out of the gate. I mean, Orson Welles would be one, and Scorsese would definitely be another, because all the hallmarks are there in Mean Streets, or even earlier with Who's That Knocking at My Door, but particularly
right.
Mean Streets.
Well, I don't think vision is – it may evolve, but that's why I love Scorsese, and I'm afraid that Wes Anderson leaves me kind of – remote. I just can't get involved in him because he's more, I don't want to say I would say it. He's kind of more like a gadfly. And Scorsese's a wasp, or if there's such a thing in New York, or something that gnaws and attacks. And there's a visceral spirit to him. Mm-hmm. That simply doesn't exist in the humanity that Wes Anderson puts on the screen, and I really don't want to denigrate Anderson, but in a sense, if we mention them both, I just don't think in any way they're equals. They're both creators,
right?
But
I don't either. I was just using that to illustrate kind of the establishment of a personal vision and. Where Wes Anderson said his grew over a period of time, it seems to me that Scorsese, he knew exactly the kind of filmmaker he was right when he started. I mean, it's blaringly obvious that the visceral camera movement, the use of popular music, that really set a context for the scenes.
And the terrific actors that he had, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's the rest? Yeah, where's the rest? Well, I bought a few rounds of drinks over here while I was waiting, you know what I mean? Tony says my credit ain't no good no more.
You know, $30 is enough of an insult.
What I take it for Charlie? $10. $10. $10. Mike, you're really something. You know that? What's the matter? You're too good for this $10, huh? You're too good for it. It's a good $10. You know something, Mikey? You make me laugh. You know that? You know, I borrow money all over this neighborhood, left and right, from everybody. I never paid them back, so I can't borrow no money from nobody no more, right? So who does that leave me to borrow money from but you? I borrow money from you because you're the only jerk off around here that I can borrow money from without paying back, right? Right? Because, you know, that's what you are. That's what I think of you, a jerk off.
Do you, did you see Mean Streets? I'm sure you did. First run when it first opened in 73?
Yes, I did. Now, here's a story. I don't think I've ever told you about it. That I was at the New York Film Festival way back when, and I saw this short subject that I could not watch. I could not keep my eyes on the screen. It was about a man shaving and cutting himself, and the blood kept falling into the sink. And it wasn't until years later that I found out that the Scorsese had made that short. That first appeared way before anything else at the New York Film Festival. And I was so lucky to get to know Marty because he sent me, from the film series that I was having in Dayton, he sent me a personal copy of Italian Americans with his mother and father. And
wow.
I showed it, and it was a tremendous, tremendous hit. So that his whole life, his whole spirit, was film and creativity and what it means for the human condition.
Well, if you...
I love you, Marty. I love you, Marty.
I sure love him, too. But, you know, I just watched Who's That Knocking for the first time last week, and it's so painfully obvious that his church was the cinema. Just from watching that movie, 90% of the conversations that transpire in that movie are about movies. You know, between Harvey Keitel and the woman that he's wooing, he just had it in his blood. What do you think is his crowning achievement?
His crowning is enduring and prevailing. I mean, how many times has he taken shots? I just think he is a great masterly filmmaker, and not every film appeals to me. Not every film works because he tries different things. He tries a musical. He tries a comedy. He has violence. He has a romance. But it is he's the whole tapestry. And
yeah.
In this time that I revisited, I think I like Scorsese 25% more than I did a week ago, just by going back and revisiting and refeeling and understanding. We talked one time about the context of the man's work and of the man's spirit. One of the things that when remember the 70s, we're going 40 years ago. This is 40 years ago that the man has been vital and vibrant and experimental and original and unique and all of those things. But at that time, when he grew up and when I grew up, there was a whole sense of cinema as a new thing that was waking up, that the French had discovered things and passed it into the American, not the mainstream, but the American creative spirit. And I looked recently on a list of the 25 greatest critics that somebody had come up with, one of these net people. And Kaufman wasn't on the list. And Dwight MacDonald wasn't on the list. And people would buy The New Yorker and read Pauline Kael's reviews, not because they were going to see the movie. They just loved the way she wrote. And
sure.
John Simon was a tremendous, he was a son of a bitch, but he was a tremendous interpreter. And Stanley Kaufman was great on the acting in cinema. And there were fights, there were tremendous fights that you would hear about even if you were teaching in Ohio or living in Omaha or in California, whatever, wherever, between Saras and Kale, going at each other. And so film criticism and the whole sense of something that was alive and burgeoning was distinctive. And remember also that back at that time, film was still struggling, people were not accepting it as an art form. That very few colleges, except UCLA and USC and NYU, had a film course at all. There wasn't such a thing as film teaching. When I went into education, and after many, many years, and then I've taught almost everything and every approach to film, but it wasn't what people accept today. When I did the experimental course on Clint Eastwood, I mean, we're teaching John Milton and Shakespeare, and you're going to bring Clint Eastwood into the English department? No, you're not. And I did it with great trepidation. Now, it was later than the 70s with Eastwood, but the course worked because he was an artist working in an art form that had layers and levels and took you down roads that you didn't expect.
Well, and you bring up film criticism. It was also an era where film criticism came to the forefront as its own art form. But Pauline Kael and Roger Ebert were major players in further establishing Scorsese. I mean, they really shined a spotlight on his early work.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, Kael became the great promoter of Robert Altman's work. And one thing I also realized was that there were so many of these directors that were prolific. I left films off my list by both of these directors, and I love both of them, and they were... Altman did 11 movies in the 1970s. He did 7 in the first 5 years. Sam Peckinpah did 9 movies in the 1970s. Can you imagine anybody, Woody Allen maybe, but other than Woody Allen, making a film a year or even more than a film a year today, where there's a fight for big budget? Here's another thing that I wanted to bring in. I'm almost too excited or too excitable. Give me the vodka, please. Pass me the vodka. But when you compare what film does today, it's made for a different market. Most of the films today are made for the overseas market. Avatar has made 73% overseas, only 27% domestically. Frozen now is going crazy overseas. There is a film that opened in China on, I have the number of screens down, it's over 6,000. 6,265 screens in this theater, and had, a week ago, made $20.5 million. Do you have any idea what it was?
In China, no.
RoboCop.
Oh, the remake.
RoboCop is appearing in 6,265 screens in China, has made more than $20 million in that country. And they changed the film over there to a special 3D version to satisfy the market. So they're not making films anymore for Americans. That's why we don't see good scripts. The dialogue doesn't matter. Instead of a sentence, you have an explosion. Well, instead of a sentence, you have 10 explosions. But language has been blown away. Pardon me?
And personal vision, which Scorsese had from the very beginning with a movie like Mean Streets, I mean, that stands in sharp contrast to what came before it as well, because this wasn't a studio movie like Hello, Dolly, which seemed like completely out in the ether. Like, who are they trying to appeal to with this? This was a guy that said, this is the world I know, and I'm going to tell it through through my prism of experience. And that's the very definition of a personal vision. And when you have to make a movie for China and India and every other country on the planet, it has to satisfy each of those audiences. How can you make a film of personal vision?
One of the things that's surprising is that personal vision was not recognized before the 60s or 70s in this country. Certainly, Hitchcock has a tremendous personal vision, but it's hidden. But now you go back and you see all of the different themes that he's working over and over again, and there's an intelligence at work, and there's symbolism, and there are motifs. We didn't recognize them. We were oblivious to the depth, and somebody like Hitchcock, who I have tremendous respect and admiration for, kind of beat the system because he offered a film that would satisfy the audience in this country, not caring that much about the foreign market back then. But also, he would put in a film that was marketable and commercial, he would put a lot of innuendo, a lot of suggestion, he would surreptitiously make points and deal with themes. And it's fascinating today to go back and open up Hitchcock. Hitchcock is endless. He is just wonderful.
It is such a delicate line to toe between maintaining, not compromising personal vision, and yet making it accessible for as many audiences as possible. And that's what fascinates me about this later stage of Scorsese's career. Probably for the first time, he is one of our most bankable directors at this stage of his career, which is amazing to me. And he's making films. I mean, Wolf of Wall Street is not compromised in any way, you know, and yet it's making huge business. And sure, I'm sure that a lot of that has to do with his pairing of DiCaprio. But if it wasn't for...
But don't you think that Marty Scorsese has a really intent ear on the marketplace and on commerciality today, and knows that there are some risks he can't take, and realizes that he has to compromise. And even though the vision is a strong one and there are some personal qualities in it, I think there's also a sense of the marketplace that makes the film much different than it would be without having to appease the gods of Mammon.
Yeah, but I don't think that he does anything he doesn't want to do. I mean, I honestly think that he's very careful at choosing what projects he wants to do, and he'll be the first one to say, no, that movie's not me. I mean, that's not something that I would do.
Right.
He wouldn't compromise himself in that way just to keep working. He's in a great spot. Let me say my first pick. This is one of my favorite movies, and you talk about Scorsese. Here's another quintessential New York filmmaker, and that's Sidney Lumet. Dog Day Afternoon is one of the most astounding movies for me, and it contains my all-time favorite performance, and that's Al Pacino in that film. Some of the things that really strike me about it is on the level of the screenplay, here is a guy that Pacino plays that you know, you learn so much about in the course of the film, and by the time the film's over, you realize that there's so much more you have yet to know about him, that you really want to know about him. And very few movies nowadays leave you wanting to know more about the people that populate them. And that's either because they spill everything about them or they're not that interesting to begin with. But these characters are intensely interesting. And at the same time, Lumet paints a really vivid portrait of a city on fire, you know, a feeling in the streets of revolt. It's a movie I adore. I watch it every year. I'm sure you love it, too.
One of the things that that's also interesting about it is his name, John Cazale.
Yes.
Who plays the guy who's going to get the operation?
Sal.
John Cazale.
Chris Sarandon is the guy that gets the operation. It's his cohort.
His buddy. That's right. Well, you know, he died very early of cancer, and he was supposed to be a great actor, and he was the boyfriend at that time of Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm.
And she really nursed him through the days of his death. And he might have been a major character actor for sure, possibly, potentially a star as well. But the Lumet is a great director. I'm very fond of him.
Well, Pacino has said, they made a documentary about John Cazale a couple of years ago, and in that documentary, Pacino said, you know, I learned the most about acting from working with Cazale, because they were very close friends, the two of them. They did, of course, the Godfather movies together,
right,
too. But Cazale is amazing, and he probably had the most amazing career of any actor. He made 5 movies. Each one of them was a masterpiece. The two Godfathers, Dog Day Afternoon, The Deer Hunter, and The Conversation. Those were his 5 movies. I mean, can you imagine? That is just jaw-dropping.
Well, one of the things about him was that he wasn't ostentatious. You almost didn't know how good he was, because he made his characters so human that you kind of missed the artistry and the timing and the ability that he created, that he rendered to his characters.
Well, and there's a moment in Dog Day that he has, and I believe it was improvised. It's a line, the funniest line in the movie, when Pacino's talking to him and saying, "Where do you want to go? We can go to any foreign country. They'll fly us out of here. We've made the deal. Let's do it. Where do you want to go?" And he thinks for a while and he says, "Wyoming." And it's a funny line, but
yeah,
he plays it in a way that really clues you in on the tragedy of that character, because
right,
this is a guy that
he's not making a joke of it.
No. It's a funny moment that becomes a heartbreaker the more you kind of examine it.
We get a helicopter here. It lands on a roof and takes us to a jet, and we fly the fuck out of the country. Sal, we can do it.
Yeah.
Give me my ready. Sarge! Ollie, you go ahead. Make phone calls. Call home or whatever. We're all going on a trip.
Yeah, Sonny.
Yeah. I want to talk to you.
I'm coming out.
Good. Okay, we'll be there.
Let's go. Come on. It's coming up. Sam. Now, you got to understand something. If we leave the country, there's no coming back here. You know what I mean? There's no coming back. So that if there's anybody now that you want to talk to, you want to say goodbye to, do it now. Is there any special country you want to go to?
Wyoming.
No, Wyoming. There's not a country.
And also, side note, they've made a documentary about the real Sonny, the real bank robber.
Oh.
It premiered at a festival last year, and so I'm sure it's going to come around soon, but I can't wait to see that, because he was living up until a few years ago, and he said that the movie Dog Day got some things wrong, but he said at the same time he's thankful for the infamy. And it was the first mainstream movie in a way, I think Friedkin's movie probably came out before The Boys in the Band, but where a major movie star was playing a homosexual, which was another thing that made it kind of a groundbreaking movie.
Well, Rock Hudson was, but we didn't notice it.
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah, that was kind of under wraps. Okay, your second film, Tony.
All right. I apologize to your audience that I got too excitable about about
this
film.
Love.
I will be more sedate on this. I'm a Philadelphian. I'm born and raised. Went to Villanova. My fourth is Rocky. Now you might say, "Whoa, what's he doing with Rocky?" Rocky is again a formulative film in the 70s. Was directed by John C. Avildsen, and he just went back to Philadelphia, and was standing by the Rocky statue at the art museum, and people would ask him to move. They wanted to take a picture of Rocky, and somebody was trying to sell him a T-shirt in Philly for Rocky. So, and he's the director, and nobody knows him. Nobody knows John C. Avildsen, and he really, Stallone wanted to direct it. He was insistent on directing it, but they wouldn't make it. They let him act in it, and they let him write it, although the initial draft was naturalistic and a lot of cursing, and it wasn't a fairy tale at all. And in the as they were making the film, Avildsen has said Stallone was such a starving artist, he would do anything. I mean, he would listen, he would be, you can't imagine him listening to anybody else today. He would be obedient, and Avildsen said, of course, there weren't cell phones back then, so it was an easier thing to do. But the film was supposed to end with Rocky sitting on the stool in the locker room, defeated, and then they put in the Adrian, the love affair, not the love affair, the moment of where he's calling to her and she's running down the arena steps. And so Avildsen was so important to the Rocky franchise because he started it, and he won the Oscar for Best Director, and it won Best Film. And it's a film that you have to suspend your disbelief, yes, of course, but I think it is one that deserves your suspending your disbelief and rewards it, and that I think there are some people who probably hate it, but I think a lot of us just go along with it, and it's a feel-good movie, but it has humanity to it.
The humanity is what sets it apart for me. The two things set it apart for me. The first thing is that the real life that revolved around that movie and getting it made and the tremendous success it enjoyed really mirrors the story of Rocky. I mean, Stallone fought. He stuck to his guns. He wanted to be in that movie. He believed in it. He was broke. They offered him a lot of money for the script, but he said, no, I have to be in it. And he knew that was his shot, and it was wildly successful, and Stallone was a Rocky story from that movie. And the second thing...
One of the things you can do today is say Rocky, and everybody knows what you're talking about. It's part of our culture.
I think so, yeah, and I think that's why people don't appreciate the purity of that first movie as much as they should, because it's become such a part of the culture now that people have forgotten just how powerful that was, that first film was. And I think the main thing that makes it powerful is that love story. The tenderness of that love story between he and Adrian it sounds corny, but it melts me every time. I think that's the key.
Well, when I was making up this list, it spoke to me. It was... Yo, Adrian. Yo, Tony. And so I had to put it on my list.
You imagine he was calling out to you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Woo! You know how I got started fighting? Huh?
No.
Am I talking too loud?
Three no. minutes.
Okay. My father, he's my old man. He was never too smart. He says to me, you weren't born much of a brain, you know, so you better start using your body, right? So I become a fighter.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Why you left?
My mother, she said the opposite thing.
What'd she say? What'd she say the opposite?
said you weren't born much of a body, so you better develop your brain.
Did she say that?
You! Time!
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Why do you want to fight?
Because I can't sing or dance. Hey, yo. Don't fall! Don't fall! Hey, that was terrific. I'm pretty good at this. You like the way I skate? You know, the last fight I had with this guy named Spider Rico.
Yeah.
He busted my head up there. You see that scar? I'll tell you. Things get pretty rough in the ring.
But it's still very relevant. I mean, they just opened up the Broadway musical of Rocky last week. And people
which I hear
crazy.
It's not that good, but has a dynamite ending where they use all these pyrotechnics, and it's supposed to be, it got a standing ovation, the last part of it when there's a fight, and it's very dramatic, theatrical.
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing it. But, that's an awfully sweet, effective movie. And anyone that's so jaded as to not see the value in that movie, I don't want to know them. There, I said it. My second movie, excuse me, my second movie is also one of my favorites, and it's my favorite Marlon Brando performance, and that's Last Tango in Paris. I think I love this movie from the first time I watched it as a teenager. I probably shouldn't have watched it at that age. And I saw beyond the... Because I'd read a lot about it. Obviously,
you never saw Butter the same, even when you were a child, right?
No, but I did read... The prelude to me watching the movie was reading Cale's review. And then I read other stuff about it, and I was prepared for a very extreme, titillating movie. In terms of English language films, that movie deals more honestly with sexual relations than any other film I've ever seen, because the sexual contents of the movie truly mirrors the psychology of the characters, and his need to degrade mirrors kind of how completely dead he feels inside, that he can't feel. Her complete openness and innocence, and I love the camera, and the camera is tangoing throughout the film. It just has this sweeping romantic quality, even when most of it takes place in this single room. And the colors in the room change throughout the course of the movie from from different shades of pink flesh color, and Brando is so completely raw in that movie, or at least
the recent death of Philip Seymour Hoffman makes me see how daring and risk-taking, I mean, I always knew it, but how these actors, like Brando, you used the word raw, in a raw part, take such a chance, take such a leap, and becomes the character, sees all of the vulnerabilities, feels all of the vulnerabilities, lives them, and I think that Hoffman's death has really I knew acting is taking risks. I knew it's daring, and I knew it's dangerous. It can be dangerous, and I knew it can be overwhelming, and it can be obsessive. But when you see Brando live the character, and the character, he becomes the character, that's a rare and sublime experience.
It really is. And talking about working on different levels, there's a scene in that film, probably outside of the Butter scene, it's the most famous scene, where he's sitting at his dead wife's bedside, and he begins to curse her, viciously curse her, until he kind of dissolves into a pool of tears on her dead body, and it goes from calling her all these obscene names to saying, "I don't know why you left. Why did you do this to me?" So, and he's acting on different levels, particularly in that scene, because even as he's saying the most foul things to her, he's professing his love for her.
Our marriage was nothing more than a a foxhole for you. And all it took for you to get out was a 35-cent razor and a tub full of water. You cheap, goddamn, fucking, godforsaken whore. I hope you rot in hell. You're worse than the dirtiest street pig that anybody could ever find anywhere. And you know why? You know why? Because you lied. You lied to me, and I trusted you. You lied. You knew you were lying. Go on, tell me you didn't lie. Haven't you got anything to say about that? You can think of something, can't you? Huh? Go on, tell me something sweet. Smile at me and say it was I just misunderstood. Go on, tell me. Rosa. I'm sorry. I just can't stand it. To see these goddamn things on your face. You never wore makeup, you fucking shit. I'm gonna take this off your mouth. You always did lipstick. Rosa, oh God. I'm sorry. I don't know why you did it. I do it to him. I do. Oh, I just don't know. God,
no. It's also, it's not just acting. Acting almost limits it. It's experiencing it. We experience the moment because he is experiencing it. We don't quite know what he's going to do next, because there is, maybe he doesn't either, because he's so in the character.
And it's also the last time he looked virile. You know, he was just starting to get a little bit of a paunch on him, but he still had that magnetism that we associated with the Brando before that. And it came right after The Godfather. Put those two performances up against one another. How is that the same person?
Right.
It's remarkable. Oh, so, yeah, I've always been, and I'm always the first to defend it, because I know a lot of people that think it's just a filthy, worthless movie. But I'm saying, no, it actually.
And what do they think about you, then?
Well, their conclusion of me is usually dead on. But you look at any American movie that deals with sex, and they don't deal with sex. They pretend to deal with it. They're dealing with the titillation and the surface of it. They don't talk about how sex is an extension of who we are and how we communicate who we are. Last Tango understands that, and that's why I love it.
Well, some of us have a longer extension than others.
Okay, on that note, give me your third movie.
My third movie is again, one I wouldn't have put on my top list during the 70s. But going back and seeing how it has evolved and its makers have evolved, my third is 1971, Dirty Harry.
Mm-hmm.
And my initial reaction was that Clint Eastwood has a few dimensions, and it is a visceral film. It has violence in it. But, again, it is one of those films that is so formative that Clint Eastwood learned from Siegel the layers. The film is not just, I've written an article a long time ago, and I was hoping it was, I couldn't find it on my website, so I'm going to send it and put it back on my website about the values of Dirty Harry. And it has the doppelganger, it has the double theme, that Harry is supposed to be this heroic figure, anti-heroic, and Scorpio is evil, just horrible. And yet, there's a sense that they are two sides of one character, that Harry's wife has been killed in a car accident. But when he he when the pedestrians are crossing in front of him, he curses them. He says, "Get out of my way!" You know, the hammerheads. Whatever. There is a great shot. There are a lot of things. There are a lot of sequences that show Harry in the same kind of action, in the same kind of setting as Scorpio. And there's this wonderful shot at the near the end, near the conclusion, where they're on the school bus, and Scorpio's on top, and Harry's in the bus, and the window, the front, the windshield, there, Scorpio leans down with his pistol, and Harry has his pistol, and they're mirror images. There is a mirror image of the two of them. And at the end of the film, which it's like the frontier is dead, that it's in a mind, and in the far distance you see traffic on the highway, and he kills Scorpio and throws away his badge, and his badge number is 2211. So the two, they both become individuals. So he's killed his alter ego. And the values of America, the antique shop is next to an adult bookstore, and both have American flags. And there is it's just a film that is, it was so significant, I think, in the launching and the development of Clint Eastwood's ability to be a great director himself. I saw Play Misty for Me the other night, and I was really surprised about how good that was. The director, Don Siegel, has a small part in it as a bartender, but he helped Clint make that film. And it, when you think back to the 1970s and 1971, you think, this guy is not going to win an Oscar, much less the impossibility of him winning two Oscars for director. And that's what he's done. His career has just evolved and evolved and evolved into an incredible legacy. And I think that Dirty Harry is a film that has qualities undiscovered qualities.
How much of that subtext do you think came from Siegel, and how much came from Eastwood? I mean,
I think almost all of it came from Siegel, probably, and the writers too. Husband and wife who wrote the film script. Now we don't know. We really don't know how much of it did. But I think the important thing is that we learn from people, and he learned from Siegel how to make a movie, and how to make a movie that wasn't just superficial. You can go through all of his films and see. You don't think of Clint Eastwood making films that have Christ figures in them, but they do throughout. And there's a sense of interpretation that the filmmaker does himself in his films, and you can go and follow and explore the doors that he's left open for you. So I would say Siegel gets the most credit, obviously, because Eastwood's still young and still developing, but Eastwood certainly was a terrific pupil.
Well, Eastwood credits a lot to Siegel, without question. But you know, detractors of that film and the series, the Dirty Harry series in general, approach it like some kind of knee-jerk conservative fantasy. do you see that, or do you see it more of
a... No, I see why they do, because it's a superficial view of the film. I mean, certainly I didn't like the film much when I saw it, because it just seemed to be violence for violence's sake and braggadocio and ego and aggressiveness. And Pauline Kael called it fascism. And I wasn't a fan of Kael, but I certainly read what she said and thought a lot about it. But I think once you get, it's like saying Hitchcock, he just makes films that are suspense. No, suspense happens to be the form, the genre, but there is a tremendous amount of thematic substance to his film. A work of art is not superficial, and it often the surface deflects our interests and our knowledge. We don't understand it. You can't like what you don't understand. I don't think you can, or very seldom can you like what you don't understand. And what these people do is they make a impulsive, knee-jerk reaction. That's one of the things that drives me nuts about the modern culture. Here's a story. Here's one that puts everything into perspective. I was at the donut shop the other day, my local haunt, and there was a girl reading a book, and I asked her what she was a college student and taking an English course. So we started to talk to her, and I gave her a brief primer about writing. This was a smart girl. This was a smart, fairly perceptive girl. We talked about language, and she knew, she got what I was saying, and she was able to respond. I said to her that I had done some film criticism. I said, your dad probably knows John Wayne. And she said, oh, yeah, I've heard of him. I know him. She had not heard of the next person I mentioned. She said, and this is a bright young woman in her early 20s, I have never heard of him. It was Clint. It was Clint Eastwood.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. What do you do with that, Harry?
Wow. Yeah, that's surprising. I guess because as an actor, he hasn't been front and center for the better part of this decade. Maybe that's
and certainly a young woman is not going to go see Gran Torino unless her boyfriend takes her, forces her to go.
Yeah,
so,
that's
but it says something about changing populaces, changing tastes, changing knowledge.
Well, my third movie. You know, I've got a list of 7 movies here, so I'm just choosing which one.
Oh, you cheater! Can't do that.
Well, you know what makes it so difficult is what I found most delicious from the 70s were the beautiful character studies. And there are several terrific candidates. I was just trying to decide between The Conversation and 5 Easy Pieces.
Well, talk about both of them.
Okay, The 5 Easy Pieces and The Conversation. These are two terrific character studies, very intimate portraits of characters that exist in that particular time. And I think they go a long way in describing who the American male was at that time. And the outsider, the loner, the person trying to find his identity and his way in the world, like Bobby Dupuis in 5 Easy Pieces, or Harry Call in The Conversation, the ultimate eavesdropper who is so fiercely protective of his own privacy, he brings along his own tragedy. And I just love, in The Conversation, it's my favorite Coppola film, and I just love the character details. I love the idea that Harry Call throughout the movie wears a transparent raincoat. Just little character traits like that are just beautiful, beautiful. And the great directors bring out the little details that illustrate a greater truth of their story and character.
Both of these films had the themes that I mentioned. Were
alienation
and irony. Certainly, his life and tearing up there's an ironic destruction that goes on, both psychologically and physically, in the conversation, and the irony of Bobby not being able to talk to his father, or trying to talk to his father, and his father being like God, not hearing him, and then at the end he's alone heading for Alaska. Both of those films are just steeped in the spirit of the films of the 70s.
Yeah, and a certain guardedness, a certain squandered life in a way, kind of like not reaching their full potential, kind of permeates both of those characters. And also, much like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, which I think is the third great character study of the 70s, I'm intensely interested in the idea of what became of these people. Did they ever find peace?
No, absolutely not. And we should mention the director of Five Easy Pieces, Bob Rafelson.
Yes.
What he did was... he did one thing in that film that I thought was just wonderful. He had the girl play a song for the girl. Bobby's playing a song on the piano for the girl. And it's beautiful. It's love it. And he plays it badly. I mean, you wouldn't know it. A real musician, it takes a real musician to know it. It sounds great, like the new, all the talent shows that are on TV. It sounds effective, but it's really kind of tacky. It's really kind of gimmicky. And Bobby's knowing that he was playing something that wasn't good, and he was not playing it well, and this woman was just in bliss about it. Talk about irony, the difference between the appearance and the reality. And Bob Rafelson also directed a film that one of my favorite films that I can't put on the list like this, but King of Marvin Gardens, where Nicholson and Dern were terrific in Atlantic City, and full of, again, those basic themes.
Okay, fourth movie, Tony, what do you got?
Well, this one I tried to drop off, and it would not leave. I have Godfather 2.
Yes.
Both Godfathers are important, although I had a friend who went to the second Godfather with Coppola, the director, and he kept saying, slower, slower, slower. The second one, Coppola makes with his personal vision. The first one he makes with personal vision, but having to prove himself and being very, very vulnerable and very, very insecure. I don't think there's any question that Godfather 2 is a better movie. Godfather 1 may be more entertaining. But this was one of the films that ended with those dead leaves blowing across in front of the bench, and that's an indelible image of loss and hopelessness, abject emotional, psychological emptiness.
Talk about it.
So Godfather 2.
Yeah, talk about an identity crisis. That's Michael Corleone at the end of that film, and the black eyes and the kind of contemplative stare.
Oh, it's not a crisis. It's all over. No, there's no crisis left. The crisis is gone. His brother's dead, and his family's dead. I mean, it's not. And Godfather 3, that came much later, is again a personal film because Coppola's son had died. And he played his daughter with her silent scream. He had the silent scream when she was killed, and it didn't.
So what does that last glance mean? I mean, what does that last black-eyed contemplative look mean? in my.
I don't think it's contemplative. I think it's empty. I mean, there is nothing. He's lost it all.
Okay.
I mean, he is. Maybe he wouldn't admit it on those terms. Maybe he said, I did what I had to do. I was pragmatic, fundamentally pragmatic, but it's cost him everything. It's cost him everything that is human or beautiful or has a potential or positive. It's all gone.
So you don't think that Michael at the end of that movie is self-aware of his journey and what he's become?
Oh, I think he's terribly self-aware, completely self-aware. How would anybody with a half a brain not be aware at that moment? Then nature is the tableau. Nature is the loss of nature, the death of the leaves, the grayness. He's no dumb man. I mean, his brains have saved the family time after time after time, but it cost and cost and cost, and he ends again the image of alienation. And it's alienation from the American dream in all of its promise.
There's something, I mean, that's my second favorite Pacino performance after Dog Day, and there's something so beautiful about what he does in that movie. He's so totally still. I think Pauline Kael described it as almost a completely immobile performance. And for someone to work from that from that stage and still kind of let you in going on there, and make you recognize the tragedy of that character, it's powerful acting. I mean, a lot of times he's expressing everything using nothing. Those black eyes and you know, the Pacino fury that he's become known for.
Right.
He releases it maybe two or three times in Godfather 2. Very, very smart moments.
But you also have to give Coppola a whole lot of credit. The direction. That's what they decided. Obviously, there's a kinship in the vision. Pacino is a perfect vessel for that.
There's a moment in that movie, the conversation between he and Cazale, where they're outside, they're drinking banana daiquiris together.
Sometimes I think I should have married a woman like you did. Like Kay. Kids. Other family. Once in my life. Be more like Pop.
Not easy to be a son, Fredo. Not easy.
Now, Mama used to tease me. She'd say, you don't belong to me. You were left on the doorstep by gypsies. Sometimes I think it's true. You know, gypsy. Mikey, I was mad at you.
Why didn't we spend time like this before?
You want a drink, right?
Waiter!
And all the way through that movie, there's such beautiful unspoken moments that you just read in the characters, and it's so well cast, and the people play so well together that you just feel it. It's in the chemistry of the room when they're together.
There's a tremendous feeling of desolation.
Yeah, yeah. Have there ever been more beautifully cast films than those first two Godfathers? I mean, it's gorgeous. Okay, so I'll choose my last one. Since I did Conversation with Five Easy Pieces, that was 3 and 4.
Now, you had one more. Didn't you have 7? Isn't there a sidetrack you wanted to...
No, I'm just revealing 5. I'm just revealing five, just like you.
Okay. Okay.
At the end of the conversation, we'll just bring up titles that might have missed for tonight.
Okay.
All right. My last choice is a director that fascinates me more than any other, and that's Bob Fosse. And the movie is All That Jazz.
Wow.
I can't think of a more – we're talking about Raw with Brando's performance. All That Jazz is a –
Now, the audience should know that one of your favorite singers is Barry Manilow, right?
Yes. Why do you have to
I just want to put – I just am adding context here.
No. I mean, this is complete. Barry Manilow is so white bread compared to what All That Jazz is. But
yes.
It's hard to imagine Manilow with demons. But All That Jazz is such a raw autobiographical film from Fosse. I think he was such an artist that this movie is so raw. He's directing his own death, his own fears of death. His own failings as a father and as a husband and as an artist and as an addict. And I just watch that movie and I marvel, first of all, at the energy of it, but just the painful honesty of it. And Roy Scheider doubles for Bob Fosse in the film as the director and choreographer who's kind of losing control of his life. He's a workaholic. He does heavy drugs. He smokes and drinks all the time. He's just like Fosse. And he's had a heart attack, but he doesn't stop. He's completely self-destructive, and he knows it's going to cause his death. And
let me
and
ask
Fosse,
you a question. You can cut this part.
Okay.
But did your own physical experience enhance this at all?
No, I've loved this movie for years and years.
I knew that. No. I don't mean that. I mean, but did it add a quality, personal quality?
It probably, yeah. I mean, if I think of it consciously like that, I'm sure that I am more susceptible to what that film, the portrait that movie plays, because I had my own self-destructive aspects as well that caused my heart attack. It's just it's so brave to me that he shoots his own death as a 30-minute musical number with Ben Vereen. And it's that mixture of the show business pizzazz with the darkest possible material you could imagine. You take those two elements, and that's Fosse. That's his style, and that's what makes him so fascinating to me as a filmmaker. I've been just intensely fascinated with Cabaret and All That Jazz and Star 80, not so much Lenny, because I think Lenny's kind of a failed movie. But
yeah, I do too.
But that trilogy is I look at that and I say, this is a man that bared himself on screen with more bravery than most other directors I can think of. What a shame that he wasn't able to make more movies. But he wasn't able to make more movies because he's the character in All That Jazz. Those
sure.
people do not last long.
No,
he burned
right.
out. Yeah. So talk about a personal vision. This is All That Jazz is about as personal as you can get from my perspective.
Well, that's the key to the 70s. I mean, that is the personal vision that is meaningful. And the thing that you think about in Fosse that I'm sure appealed to you was that it was all of this emotion and all of this color. But the thing that appealed perhaps even more than that was the intelligence.
Yeah.
The intelligence
well,
of the movie.
It was the probing. It was okay. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to lay myself bare. I'm going to let the buzzards pick my bones clean. I'm not going to sugarcoat this at all. I just admire the hell out of that, and that's what makes his films great art for me, and so revealing. Revealing every time you watch them. So And it's interesting to me how Roy Scheider, he didn't know anything about Broadway. He did not come from that world. And yet, the second he's on screen, I mean, he just exudes it. You would think that he was Mr. Showbiz like his whole life. It's an amazing performance. Richard Dreyfuss was fired from the movie after 1 week because he and Fosse didn't get along. So it was almost Dreyfuss.
Well, it's a much better casting. Richard Dreyfuss would not have. Let me tell you something about Richard Dreyfuss. We're talking about the films of the 70s. Well, what lurked under the water of the 70s in 1975 was Jaws, which changed films forever.
Mm-hmm.
It brought the blockbuster in. There's a moment in that film, I was talking about the negative downbeat ending. In Jaws, Dreyfuss, the shark has attacked, Dreyfuss has gone under the water and he is dead. And here is the moment that changes, that gives us movie false hope. Out of the water pops Dreyfuss. Now in any story with reality to it, it doesn't happen. But he, so the end, it was a feel-good ending. Now, it could have been a man against nature, tremendous epic tale, but when he popped out of the water, film in a sense said, okay, we've had enough negative, we've had enough downbeat. From now on, we're not going to have as much, we're not going to allow as many personal visions with
right.
This,
but don't
with,
you don't,
with,
don't you think the audience is the one that said that?
Oh yeah, of course. And I was happy. My heart leapt. My mind shut down. There's a constant battle between emotion and mentality. But we're talking about the personal films. But in the 70s, there was also the blockbuster that was going to destroy and end the personal film, the kind of personal film that there had been before. In 72 was Poseidon Adventure. In 74 was The Towering Inferno. And this huge, big kind of movie that would work with an overseas audience because it's flame and it's quote tragedy unquote. But when you mention Dreyfuss, that always comes to me of him popping out of that water and saying, okay, the movies are going to change. We're going back to happier times.
Yeah, I agree with you. But
do I get to mention my best film?
Absolutely, but if Jaws hadn't made money, we would have many more years of these kinds of movies that we're talking about. Obviously,
maybe not. Maybe they had run their course because a lot of these directors were becoming Dennis Hopper and they were all becoming, in a sense, almost entitled and very, very egotistical. That maybe the humanity that we loved so much in the first half of the 70s and was still alive in the last half of the 70s and is still alive every once in a while in movies these days. And I find myself in limbo or purgatory because I'm always arguing with the older folks that the movies are better today than they think they are. And I'm arguing with younger folks that you don't have any context. You aren't able to provide any context to it. You've seen one movie, and there are 10 that have done it better, but that's the only one you know. And the private eye in film noir has turned into a vampire. My whole life I have loved Alienation. Probably I was forced to because I never seem to belong to any particular group. That I'm always iconoclastic.
By the
so
way,
yes.
Studio heads are listening to us talking right now, and based on your suggestion, they're remaking the Maltese Falcon with vampires right now.
Hey, it's a good idea.
You have that to look forward to.
I'm really ready for Citizen Werewolf.
Yes. Okay, your last film.
Not Citizen Kane. You understood the allusion.
I understand the joke.
Okay. When you have to explain your jokes, you're pathetic, Macklin. All right. My number one of and again, it could change by the time I hang up. We stop this conversation. But my number one had who I feel is the actor of the 70s. Now, you could say De Niro, and De Niro certainly was paramount, but he went on to Raging Bull, which I think probably was his best performance. This actor gave his best performance. You might disagree which one it was, but he gave his best performance in the 70s. It was also a very personal film by the director, who changed the ending because by changing it, it became a personal expression of grief and loss. And I'm talking about 1974 and Roman Polanski's Chinatown. Now, his wife in 69, Sharon Tate, had been murdered by the Manson clan. The actor was Jack Nicholson, and I think he is sensational. You might prefer his Oscar-winning performance in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or King of Marvin Gardens, or The Passenger, all of which were in the 70s. So he had, and of course, the two Rafelson films, Five Easy Pieces and King of Marvin Gardens. So for me, he was the actor that embodied the spirit of the 1970s, with his alienation, with his, what you said, his outsider quality, with the irony. And one of the things that made me dislike a film that almost everybody liked is when Nicholson did About Schmidt, because it had no irony. It was Nicholson without irony. And it was like he lost his soul. I mean, he's good in that film. It was a commercial, popular film, but it wasn't the Jack that I knew and trusted, and was so significant to the films of the 1970s. And 74 was the year both of Godfather 2 and Chinatown. What a year!
I've rewatched Chinatown, you know, probably for the 10th time last year, because it came out in a really beautiful Blu-ray, and that David Fincher does commentary on, of all people. It's Fincher and Robert Towne talking in the commentary track.
Well, Fincher loves irony. Fincher's the director, one of the few directors who still seems to have a sense of irony.
And I interviewed Robert Towne about Chinatown when the thing came out, and what a supremely, just gorgeously crafted movie, first of all.
Well, a couple of things about Brown. Did you talk about the changing of the ending? That in the ending, in his ending, Evelyn lived.
Yes.
And of course, when Polanski became the director, it was almost impossible for her to live at the end. And
that was the right choice. And Robert Towne didn't think it was the right choice at the time, but in retrospect...
He's come to... The other thing, I think it's the film that I most like to teach, because as an educator, I can open eyes more about what goes on in that film. The doubles, everything is two. There are two every, and one is always spoiled. I'm the mother, the daughter, both at the same the mother and the sister. The headlights or the real lights, one is out. The $2 bill. I mean, there's all kinds. It's one of those films that's most fraught with symbolism, and not symbolism that is tacked on, but is generic, because there are two sides, good and evil. There are two sides, flaw and unflawed. There are two sides, positive and negative, that which succeeds and that which fails. And that is tremendously, it doesn't waver. And it's stylistically so astute in using the duality. I guess I prefer the film dualities in Chinatown, to work with the dualities and what they mean. Discover them, and there are like 30 to 40 of them, and then what they mean, to understand, to comprehend, to explore their meaning. And that is a film that just is brilliant in emotionally and stylistically.
Well, and it's the first movie, as you mentioned, comes on the heels of his wife being murdered. That's the first movie that Polanski made in the States after his wife was murdered, and the last one, because he had to flee a couple of years later.
Right.
So Polanski does just a masterful job at adhering to the stylistic and the structural traits of a classic film noir, but using those in the service of a very, very dark film.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a man that isn't only raping the land, he's raping his own blood. It's haunting movie.
But 50% of the audience leaves. What did he say at the end? What did he say? He said,
yeah,
it's Chinatown, dude, Jake. It's Chinatown. What's that mean?
Another Nicholson character that leaves at the end of that film in complete limbo.
Oh, no. Hell. Forget limbo. There's no limbo for him. Limbo is the land of lost souls, or soul, the unbaptized. He is in hell. He is. I mean, it's not. There may be ennui, and there may be a loss of feeling, and that's what you may mean by limbo. But it's excruciating. It's excruciating.
I mean exactly what you just said, that he's a lost soul. I mean, because before he took this case, he was trying to recover from, if I remember this plot correctly, he was trying to recover from a past incident, wasn't he?
Yes, he didn't save another woman.
Yeah.
So he's guilt-ridden, which is also one of the themes that we could add on, the guilt that is so much a part of so many of these characters. The guilt of not belonging, the guilt of failing, the guilt of being, of making mistakes, of doing the wrong thing, going down the wrong lane. Do we want to talk, Ed, the other titles?
Yeah, just mention the titles that you had.
Well, I had Five Easy Pieces, which we talked about, King of Marvin Gardens, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Antonioni's The Passenger, All the President's Men. You can't forget Star Wars, because that is the only film in the top 100 that has made it. It's the only American film of the 70s that has made the top 100 in foreign grosses. The Star Wars, and then Night Moves.
Yeah.
Do you remember Night Moves?
Oh, talk about
a
great Private Eye movie. I mean, that's a beautiful movie. Oh, I love that film. Yeah. You mentioned,
and the ballad, one of my favorite. I mean, I don't want to. Almost all of Peckinpah's films almost all of Altman's films. Ballad of Cable Hogue is one of my favorite Peckinpah's. Junior Bonner, I love. Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is one of, I think, a great film. And then Altman, name an Altman film from the 70s that the 11 films that he made, any of them. Brewster,
yeah.
McLeod, MASH, Miss Cave and Mrs. Miller, Images, Long Goodbye, Thieves Like Us, Nashville, Buffalo Bill and the Indians, Three Women, Not a Wedding or a Quintet, but all of the others.
Well, Cuckoo's Nest was the first movie that made me fall in love with movies. I remember watching it as a little kid. And I think that movie is so relevant to today as well because, I mean, it's really about a big the big system suffocating every ounce of dignity and individualism out of everyone it touches. And, you know, we have that today. And I think it's just a beautiful story. I've always been attracted to that story. I had McCabe and Mrs. Miller is one of my all-time favorite movies. It's probably in my top five of all time. It
really?
has such an indefinable quality about it. There's such a melancholy beauty about that.
Well, what makes it, one of the things that adds to the melancholy is the music by Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just wonderful. It's just haunting. There's a quality
and also
to it.
The fact that that you feel like in the best Altman films, you feel life kind of growing around the actual movie. The fact that they built that town as they were shooting the film, so it was the whole community was growing in the process of making the film. I mean, it becomes a living thing. He has a way of adding elements that very intangibly alter the chemistry of the movie. Yeah, I love Altman. Shampoo is one that...
Yes, that was on my list, too.
Just as...
How about Being There?
First of all, I love Ashby, and I love Being There. And I love Shampoo. I watched that again last week as well, and just on the simple basis of a travelogue of L.A. at that particular period of time, I mean, that's a great L.A. movie.
Well, I told you my story. I think I told you my story of meeting Warren Beatty and saying to him at a table and saying to him, just answer yes or no. And I said, is your character, is he like Jack Kennedy? He walks the beach and he loses the girl to Les. And he said no. Next, and then he's answering another question. He turns back to me and he said, "I never thought of that. That's amazing." And then later he told somebody that he said that son of a bitch saw something in my film that I didn't see. So for me, it's a great critical moment, interviewer's moment.
And we actually played that clip on one of your appearances on the show, the baby interview.
Right.
The only thing that's difficult for me about that movie is I know it's entirely a Warren Beatty movie. And I adore Hal Ashby, but I know that's probably not an Ashby film. That he was kind of, he knew that he needed a hit, and he just took direction and abuse from Warren Beatty, who was really in charge of that movie.
Right.
Something like Being There or The Landlord, you know, stuff like Last Detail. I mean, that's Ashby. All the President's Men, I think, is a perfect movie, and it's one of the great, this might sound odd, but it's the greatest people at work movies I've ever seen. And I love movies like that.
It's one of those films that has a positive ending. The fall of the villain.
And you learn everything you need to know about them by watching them work.
By the way, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying, you know, this discussion of the films of the 1970s is going back to a class reunion or a college reunion that it's kind of awkward. You're trying to remember who is who and what is what, and it awakens memories that have been buried or closeted for 30 years. And I said to you before that I could talk for 3 hours on this. Well, I think I could talk on 3 days. It's inexhaustible.
Yeah.
And it's nostalgic, and we talked about, of all things, we talked about quality. And there's something resonant to me about that.
Yeah. Well, I...
Yeah, you sound like Charlie Rose in the background saying, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I
yeah.
know that I get into altercations with people sometimes where they're saying there was just as much crap made in the 70s as there is today.
Different kind of crap.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, but if you look at...
There's a difference between bird droppings and horseshit.
I don't know that the quote-unquote great movies of today will live like those great movies of the 70s, because there's a relevancy in those movies made 40 years ago.
I challenge you to come up with great movies, of a whole list of great movies in present time.
The movies that we're talking about challenge you. That's a big component of what makes them great, and I think so often the movies that are deemed great today offer no challenge. They're so easily digestible that people think they're great because they appeal to everyone.
Well, we probably should at least mention, how do you think 12 Years a Slave would have fit into the 70s? And compare its making today with the making, if it had been the attempt to make it in the 70s. What do you see any difference, or do you see it being a great film, or how do you see it? Because that's the film that just won the Oscar as the best film of the year.
Yeah, I mean that's a big question. I don't actually know. I don't necessarily feel a 70s sensibility in 12 Years a Slave.
The other thing is, do you see, I think it's a good film, an important film, but do you see a personal director's vision? Do you see Steve McQueen as,
you know,
the artist that Scorsese is, or that Altman was, or that Peckinpah, or any of them were?
I honestly hate to say it, I see Steve McQueen as a sensationalist. I don't see the depth of personal vision in his films. I see a button pusher and
okay.
Else.
I wouldn't go so far. I'm not disagreeing, but I wouldn't go so far as to say an existentialist, although he may well be, but I don't think he has the depth of personal vision, as you said. I really don't see it in his work. I still think perhaps the directors that are closest to the 70s are the Coen brothers, because they have a personal vision, they're willing to take risks, they know what they're after, they are willing to accept accident and fortuitous occurrence and what happens, what surprises, but there's a sense that there's a personality and a personal vision between them in their creative outlook and creative
creation.
Yeah.
And I, I do see the Scorsese and the Altman in someone like P.T. Anderson. You know, I think that he's kind of like the bastard stepchild of
the mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, three other quick titles that I always return to from the 70s are I do love Badlands.
I do too. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's high on my list. I think that's a wonder. I'm running out of adjectives, but it's a memorable film and it really worked. It really delivered on what Malick was after, I think.
Yeah. Taxi Driver. That
no, go ahead. Tell me what your reaction to it was.
To Badlands?
Yeah.
Badlands is it's one of those movies that I find completely transcendent. And it seems to me in Malick films that's the one thing he's trying to find. He's trying to find that feeling of transcendence in his movies. But the movie that accomplished it most in his resume is the most straightforward, which was Badlands.
Jamie, damn. Here I'm trying wonderful, and you don't transcend it. You just blew me away. You just blew me out of the language.
It transcended wonderfully.
It is transcendent. That's a perfect word.
And oh my God! And the just the nature of those two performances. It's just flawless. It does feel like you're in a completely different universe when you watch that movie.
And there's a violence, but it's not gratuitous, and it's not in your face, and it's not vulgarized
right.
It's a violence that lives and breathes.
I've already mentioned Taxi Driver, one of the great characters ever for me, Travis Bickle. And then the Bergman movie I continue to return to is Cries and Whispers, and that's from 73. And an interesting story about Cries and Whispers, I was talking to Roger Corman.
I'll decide whether it's interesting, okay?
Roger Corman, in the 70s, he bought a lot of art films, Cries and Whispers among them, and played them at drive-in theaters across the country. I said, what, a Bergman film at a drive-in theater? How did that go over? And he said, not well. But you don't associate Corbin with, you know, Antonioni and Bergman films, but that was an interesting part of his background.
One of the major things that was so important and indelible in the 60s was you would go to an art theater and see the latest Truffaut or the latest Bergman. And Bergman was sensational. His appeal on the art film circuit was extraordinary. Now he's a forgotten director. Hardly anybody remembers Ingmar Bergman. And then at a certain point, probably in the 70s, in the late 70s, all these art theaters turned into adult film theaters, porno theaters. And the foreign film, which was so much a part of awakening these directors and giving them a sense of self and style and promise and potential, came from France and Italy and the great, great foreign directors. And that was a part of film that is gone because we don't, very seldom do we hear, oh, you've got to see this French film or you've got to see the new film by whoever it may be, a Tornatore. You don't hear that anymore. And it used to be that Cale, Saris, Simon, MacDonald, Haskell, David Elliott, who's one of my favorites, who wrote for In Chicago and then San Diego, they always wrote about the new films that came from Europe. And there was a tremendous enthusiasm for it that has just disappeared. And when it's like part of the world of movies is defunct. It is no more.
Well, all of these direct, all of these American directors that we've talked about tonight, we wouldn't have them without the Bergmans and Kurosawa, particularly, and Antonioni and all of these French New Wave artists and foreign directors. They wouldn't exist because they were in.
And we shouldn't forget, Fellini either, because Fellini, I still think La Dolce Vita, although the orgy scene is so dated, but I still think his sense of alienation is as strong as is on as has been put on film, especially at the end of La Dolce Vita, where the Marcello Mastroianni character is standing alone with only a party around him, nothing that makes any that has any meaning or has any significance at all.
Scarecrow is a film I love that I constantly return to with Pacino and Hackman, one of the best Hackman performances in that movie. You know, in terms of horror films, I think Texas Chainsaw is the granddaddy. And I think that because a lot of people fight me on this, but I think that horror films can be taken seriously as an art form because horror, by its very nature, can really get at the submersive kind of social and political landscape of the time without beating you over the head with it, even when people are being beaten over the head during the movie.
Kathy, I have an assignment for your listeners, especially the psychologically oriented. Try and figure out what makes a person who loves both Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Barry Manilow. Now that's
I know. That's a psychological profile right there.
That's great.